welcome to episode 32 of Island CT Podcast,
a podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast. And we have a guest.
We do.
Hello, my name's Isaac. I'm Pat and Kelly's son.
So, the recording volume looks good. Okay.
Okay, good.
So, it is March 26th.
Mm-hmm.
We are in Georgia.
Right.
We're recording with the old mic.
Right.
So, it's going to sound a little bit different. The Samsung, which we had a while ago.
Right.
And do we have any administrative stuff?
No administrative stuff, but I thought one way we could start is for actual blogs, we usually write about something we've just done. So we'll have Isaac start with just what are some things you've been working on.
How about we do the stuff we're working on last? Because we always go future, what we've worked on, and then future plans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
got it.
I think that
okay.
works better.
Okay. So we'll move on down.
Good, the science.
To things. Okay.
Unless, I didn't read your blog. It's already written.
Yeah, it's about.
It's about the maker. So that should go at the end also.
Yeah.
Okay.
Agreed.
So start physics, math, chem type stuff.
Or okay, so you want to go the physics route? Okay, so let's hear about CERN.
CERN?
All right, I thought you had one with some open source with CERN.
I was going to do that at the end. That's more tech.
I'm prepared.
No, that's not physics.
Okay.
Yeah, we have the peanut gallery here. This is on the show.
I'm just like, okay, Pat, tell us what you want to do.
No, we start doing the by topic, right?
Okay.
And we're doing physics first.
Physics, okay. Okay.
Let's go with
physics.
There's the whole
Pluto thing. I had a very short one about CERN, and it's talking about their new, well, maybe a new particle that they have found, or either it's just a larger Higgs molecule.
Particle.
Mm-hmm. But they still have to do more tests. It seems heavier than the Higgs.
Is this a news story?
Yeah, it was a news story in Science, and it was written by Adrian Cho on March 18th. And so they're going to be doing further tests at CERN, and it'll be pretty cool because if they find this is actually a new particle, it will add extra spatial dimension to the so-called axon.
You showed me this earlier today.
Yeah, so they're thinking that this new particle will be the Z boson particle.
Yeah. I didn't really understand a lot of it.
Right, that's why I'm just doing it as a minor.
It looks like it fits into the standard model. It's just like that stuff. Keep it as a minor one?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, you wrote a lot about it. Or is this copy?
Well, I had to try to figure it out. Anyway.
Okay. So that's all we have for physics. It's too bad. You know, the Pluto, all of the New Horizons stuff came out. They published in the last Science.
Oh, really?
I haven't had a chance to look at it.
I haven't either. We'll have to dig into it.
So.
Saw a lot of the really neat pictures that came out of there, though.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're all over
on the web.
Yeah.
I heard an interview with, you know, the project lead. That guy is so charismatic and excited about this stuff, and he was saying they prioritize the data coming back from New Horizons, and the most important stuff is now all back. But still, there's just fantastic stuff coming every day that they really care about.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the geology is so much more than they'd expected with all this activity. So that's really neat. He was talking that they were actually thinking they might at some point be able to divert it to hit another transneptunian object. I don't remember its name. Yeah, so there might be even more data being collected in the future.
Nice. So,
but yeah, I saw all those articles. I wanted to look at them, but well, we've been incredibly busy. Mm-hmm. So okay, so we're not much physics there. No chemistry.
No. Nope.
Skip mine. So then we're biology, which is kind of our staple.
Okay. So we can start with the winemakers.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
So the winemakers, due to climate change, our current study finds that the warming has actually helped the development of the wines, and the grape harvests have been very high quality and that. And it's kind of neat because in the study they also found that over the last 400 years they have had earlier and earlier development of the grape on the vine. And so, you know, the way that their growing season goes depends that they have a wet spring, hot summer, and a late season drought. And so, although it's beneficial to them now, if they have a shift in the climate change for their particular area, then that can really change where the wines are grown.
From your notes, I got a really strong sense that it was important for them to have a hot summer within the drought later.
Yes.
And that was changing. It was the pattern
that was
changing.
Yeah, it was the pattern that was changing, and that will also affect the quality of the harvest.
But you know, they only looked at France and Switzerland.
Yeah.
The way I understand it.
Yeah.
So, and these are all records. I don't know. Different areas in the world are being affected by climate change differently.
Well, I think the point is that it's a 400-year-old.
It's a very long record.
It's this huge data set that they, and they probably went there because of that large data set that they could work with to look at it in terms of climate change. Yeah.
Any other closely related stuff from yours, or do you want me to move on? I don't have anything even close to that.
I have some, another plant one, talking about harvest. So there's an article in Science, again, on March 21st, and it is by Virginia Gwynn, and it's called Wild Relatives of Key Crops Not Protected in Gene Banks Study.
Where is this?
And this is, I actually put a link to it. It's further down.
Further down? Okay.
Yep, after the physics one. So what they've looked at is the data or the gene bank that they have in store for the current crops. And they became really concerned because there is more than 95% are insufficiently safeguarded in the world's gene bank. And then that doesn't even include all the wild varieties of the plants. And they're saying for us to have viable crops in the future, we have to have that gene bank to protect it from disease and blights.
We talked about that this morning, yeah.
We did.
And when you showed me that, what was it that I said?
You start talking about the banana.
And stuff.
Yeah,
so my reaction was not specifically about what they were looking at, but about this idea that, using the banana as an example, that varieties that were very common early in the century are no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And they've kept changing them, presumably because of blights, and that there's some varieties that are eaten locally, which are very good, but will not stand transportation. So they're not going to ever be important on the world market. But the ones that do survive transportation for, I don't know, how many days to make it to market, then one becomes popular. It's the best one. It outcompetes the others on the world market, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's exposed, like, why do we keep losing it? It's exposed to all sorts of fungi and bacteria that it's never normally exposed to. Because now it's spread all over the world. And that makes it back to the original place. And it makes you wonder, how many varieties are we losing? Because once they become commercially successful, it becomes a way for the pathogens to reach local areas where they never had a chance.
Because of transportation and, yeah, just handling the materials.
And these aren't even wild ones. So.
Yeah. And that would be very difficult to control as well.
Yeah. Anyway, move on from that one. We're going through this very fast. This is cool.
We are.
Go to some of mine because
before
you, I saw you had the Neanderthal one, and I have more like biology that's like lower.
Okay.
You know, for me. So the first one was one on fungal diversity. It's from Science. It's from March 11th. Let me remember what it's about. Okay. So fungus is really tough to categorize in terms of scientific nomenclature and families and stuff, right? Because it's so complicated. And, but there are criteria put out, like a lot of these organisms, you culture them, and if you can culture them and show you've got a monoculture, then you can give it a name, right? And then you can describe it, right? And now people are going out, they scoop up a soil sample, and instead of looking for particular organisms, they do shotgun DNA analysis,
right?
And they can tell they have a bunch of different organisms by looking at only certain genetic sequences that match over and over, but slightly different. And too different for them to come from the same organism, but different enough that they know, I mean, too different that, so they can't be from the same organism, but close enough that they know what gene it is or what open reading frame or what piece of DNA, right? Turns out, actually, a lot of these you can't culture, and that they know. And as a matter of fact, most of them are that way, they're finding it.
Right.
So you've got this humongous diversity of organisms that we didn't think existed, and now we know are there, and there's no way to categorize them.
On the current, using the current system.
So, I mean, this was a call to, not to change the system, right? Because it's got very useful, restrictive rules for what becomes named as a species, but to come up with a parallel system for how do we handle all of these genetic sequences that we know show that there's an organism there that we can't culture. So that was kind of cool.
That
That one was from page 1150. So that was the first microorganism one. And then the second one was unbelievably cool. This one, it's about a bacterium that basically, in a kind of like rough language, degrades plastic.
I just glanced
This is actually the only scientific report that I read. Everything else was like news type stuff. This is not the first time. There's been isolated cases, but not anything that's was this strong, the way I understand it, and attacking something this inert, I think. I'm not sure. I can't remember. This was like already 2 weeks ago. And it is degrading PET, polyethylene terephthalate. Terephthalate. PET for short. And so this is what they did. They knew from some other studies that showed that some of these synthetic, highly inert chemicals get degraded in the wild by some organisms. And there were two fungi that were particularly good, if I remember correctly. They're both filamentous, both from the genus Fusarium. And so they've been shown to do some degradation. So they looked at all different places in the world where you had high contamination of PET. And they started to culture all these samples on media that contained PET. And then they did selection on that, figuring both that they'd start off with a sample that should have organisms that have adapted, and also that their procedure would isolate for it. Mm-hmm. And they found one sample. Let me see. What do they call it? Sample. It's just a number. Yeah. Subculture number 46.
The magical one.
The magical one.
Not 42, though.
Not 42. yeah, and basically, it could degrade PET really quickly.
Wow.
Compared to anything else they had before.
That's really cool.
They found a bunch of stuff in there. There was some yeast, there was some bacteria and stuff. They subcultured over and over, always selecting to try to get mm-hmm. monocultures. They found a bacterium that seemed to be able to do it by itself without any of the other organisms there. Okay. And then in the subcultures, they also found one that bacterium didn't make it. And that culture was not able to degrade PET anymore.
Oh, interesting.
So then they went even further. They looked for the genes required, and they found actually the enzymes. And I'm not going to go into this. I read deep into it at the time, and it was really cool, the mm-hmm. chemistry. They're really difficult bonds for natural organisms to hit.
Oh,
they're,
wow.
Because they're unusual in nature.
Right.
And so that's, but it seems like you've got organisms now all over the world that are starting to evolve in this very unusual way. And the interesting thing is, if you get a mutation, right, so this is nothing from this article, but if you get a mutation, it's going to be deleterious. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the rules of statistic. Mm-hmm. But microbes are so fast at adapting because, number one, high numbers very fast turnover, mm-hmm. and number two, they already have a huge panoply of enzymes and combinations of parts of enzyme that can get rearranged.
Right, because they rearrange in many ways.
Exactly.
Both conjunction and using binary fission.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But coming up with a catalytic center that hits something that's just not around in nature, that's useful as a form of energy, that's a different story, right? Because it's mm-hmm. not finding the ones that's just slightly different. So,
oh, that's really neat.
Yeah, so that one was really cool. So I have another cellular type one that has to do with humans. Do you have, I didn't notice any other biology type ones except for the Neanderthals. So.
No, I do not have other biology ones.
Then I'll do my next one.
Okay.
This is from, I didn't mention where, did I mention where the...
No, you did not.
PET bacteria. So that was a report, I think. Yeah, it must have been because it was pretty short. Science, March 11th also. Mm-hmm. And it's on page 1196. Great electron micrographs.
Nice.
And other data. Okay. So this next one is from the March 18th issue. And it's from page 1264. It's our perspective,
mm-hmm.
And it has to do with a type of cell found in the intestine, the Tuft cell, which mm-hmm. has been kind of, it hasn't been well understood what its role was.
Mm-hmm.
It's in quite low numbers relative to other cells, so density.
Right.
There's basically four cell types, if I remember correctly. I can't mm-hmm. remember exactly. So you've got your basic enterocytes that are absorptive, but all the others are secretory for one reason
right.
or another. And the Tuft cells, they have microvilli, they stick out into the lumen.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the inside, they seem to be making some connections with the enteric nervous system, maybe. Not totally certain about all that. But what they found in this particular, or what they're reporting in the news piece, is about research that found that, and I think this was using mice studies, that the Tuft cell was the only source of one of the interleukins, IL-25. Okay, so I don't know exactly how they know that, but I assume they ablated the Tuft cells and found there was no more source for it. Maybe not. a subinternet. I don't remember. Anyway, but they know somehow that it's the only source of IL-25. They also know from a long time that you get a parasitic infection, like worms and stuff in the intestine, you get high immune response that goes through the IL-25 pathway.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And in the mice, when they got rid of the Tuft cells, they lost that response to the parasitic infections, and then all the downstream effects that include the appearance of other immune cells and everything disappeared. And then they could drive it by genetically putting it back in.
So right.
I'm doing this from memory. I hope I remember, because this was from a week ago. But anyway, it was cool manipulation.
Neat.
I didn't see, we haven't talked about CRISPR yet. I don't think they used CRISPR for this, but it sure sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and downstream effects are the typical IL-13.
Okay.
Anyway.
Nice.
So one interesting thing for Western societies is that that would be the same pathway that's involved in food allergies.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that to me.
Yeah. Anyway.
Which is really cool.
That's all I have for, I don't really want to go any further because I don't remember much about
it. Do you remember anything about the forensics?
Yes,
article?
I have.
Okay, that one interests me, but I didn't get to it.
You want me to cover that?
Sure.
Okay. Forensics. The March 11th issue of Science had a special section on forensics. I just picked three that I found kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. One has to do with the use of DNA technology in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's been a large number of cases now, it looks like, of people falsely convicted.
Oh, wow.
And just to summarize, because we're just going to go through this real quick, right?
Right.
So it looks like this is what happened. The genetic evidence for someone being at a place, at a crime scene, has been a boon to forensic early on. You find the DNA there, right? And you can pretty much guarantee that you have matched that DNA to a particular person.
Right.
So suddenly you've got this really strong connection that there was no other way.
Right. I understood that from.
And you need minute quantities of DNA.
Right.
Okay. So that's all fine, and that worked well.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, technology kept getting better and better,
mm-hmm.
which meant that we could identify the DNA from smaller and smaller sources of DNA.
Okay.
So it went from you needed a sample of saliva or
blood
or something to someone just needed to touch the place, and you could get enough of the DNA out
from
and expand
touching?
It. Yes, just touching.
From dead cells.
Just from dead cells and sweat and
wow.
stuff. Okay. So then the people were using these techniques earlier on, they kept up with the technology, right? Because
right.
now, when they could barely tell whether someone was there, now they can tell for sure.
Right.
The problem is that the procedures for how you handle the equipment and all that type of stuff hasn't changed. So now, you have a crime scene,
mm-hmm.
and you have suspects.
Right.
And one person interviews the people that are suspects. They might never have been at the crime scene at the right time. They handle stuff that they handled. They handle stuff at the crime scene. And the investigators transfer these minute quantities to the crime scene or to objects from the crime scene that were collected. And then suddenly, you've got the DNA. Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
And a huge number of people, supposedly. And so now there's a big program.
About how that evidence is taken care of and what protocol
Well, trying to get people out of jail.
Yeah.
That were convicted, and now it looks like, yeah.
Because actually, it was one of the books that you were required to read going to UNC, Picking Cotton.
Oh, yeah.
And that guy actually got out of jail after 11 years because of the DNA evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the most famous, they say, the most famous, I hadn't heard about this case, example of the false conviction is Amanda Knox and a friend. It happened in Italy. They were convicted. There was a confession under duress. And they spent 4 years in prison. And when this guy who started this program, he went through the records of what the police had done. Mm-hmm. And he had his students and postdocs and whatnot basically do the same thing again. And they could find people's DNA, you know, in their faked crime, actual crime reenactment and stuff. They could find people's DNA that were totally unconnected, including people that were some of the ones supposed to investigate.
Wow. Right?
Which normally you get that. You're like, oh, well, you throw it out because you
right.
know, right? That's almost, so anyway.
Wow.
So that was one of the forensics ones. There was one cool one about how do you find out the source of the material used in a nuclear bomb?
Yeah.
If it's detonated, for example, in the United States in a city,
mm-hmm.
you find out where the nuclear material came from so you can then
track it down
do further. Yeah.
And maybe
right.
track where that came from and
right.
do.
So, all sorts of interesting things, including
yeah.
using the National Ignition Facility to create fake glass, you know, the
mm-hmm.
glass that shows up under nuclear explosions.
Yeah.
The main determinant of what the glass is like is the actual nuclear material, and even more important, the materials there. So they're basically going to New York City and other places, seeing what are the main construction materials and the geology,
mm-hmm.
replicating those
conditions,
those materials
mm-hmm.
in the right proportions, and then making glass out of it and seeing, well, what's the properties.
Wow.
To say, well, this is our base. If this was this type of nuclear material and it was in this location, then it should look like this. But if it was
right.
this type of nuclear material from the same location, it should look different, I guess.
Right.
The other thing that was really cool from that one is the deployment, I guess it's happening right now, of a system called Discrete Oculus.
Mm-hmm.
So when a nuclear explosion goes off, you get sound waves, you get pressure
right.
waves that are not in the sound frequencies, you get radiation from
mm-hmm.
the blast. And you get seismic waves.
Right.
So Discrete Oculus is sensors deployed around major U.S. cities. They have all sorts of sensors associated with them to pick up all of those. Because we've done so many nuclear tests in the past, we have a lot of data of what the stuff is supposed to be sending out.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that's going to be deployed. If something happens, it'll be continuously recorded. And it will have recorded with the natural sounds that you have in those areas and other
mm-hmm.
seismic activities, so we have a background.
Right.
And then they have another system called, I can't remember, but it's a smaller version. It travels around in the van and stuff, so you have, like, Olympic Games. You deploy
right.
your system.
Right,
in
there.
Order, some major
oh,
events,
hey.
Concerts and
That's
stuff.
That's very cool. Yeah.
So it's, yeah. The last one, Isaac, you're going to love this one. This is, I guess there's been a lot of busts of people using Bitcoin-type currencies to launder money.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea is that... it was supposed to be untraceable.
Right.
But it turns out that there's, you know, the system is not traceable in and of itself, but it's like everything else. There's other factors not part of the precise Bitcoin theory that make it that you have inroads into it. So, for example, one of the guys that got caught had used the same user login that he had created years before on some other system and the
password reuse
stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they've been able to actually track. I guess the big step that they found they can do with a fair bit of effort is to match IP address to a person making a transaction. So Let's see. Yeah, that's kind of cool. That's all I looked at for the forensics.
Okay. I'm thinking we may shift to what we've been doing because I'm going to have to take a break.
Okay. So I'm going to bring up the calendar.
Okay.
Because it's all about the timing.
Right.
Well, we had a lot of building going on. And was it like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago? Yeah. 2 weeks ago, we had all three of the all six transmitters, the first six transmitters for 80 meter ARDF built. And so last Thursday, for the first time, we got out with the kids at Smith Middle School.
Yeah.
And had an ARDF session, and it worked really well.
Much better than we had hoped for.
Yeah.
We didn't know if we would gather kids together to tell them what it was, and they'd be like, so what?
So that's what I wrote my blog entry about. So that's number, I can't remember. I think it's 65.
So we had eight kids running around. I had six more back in the room that wanted to go and were upset that they didn't get to go for the full time. And we were able to get through about nine kids,
giving at least
an introduction.
Yeah. What was really cool is that, so we thought, maybe we should explain, like it's in the blog, but maybe we should explain. We set out three transmitters right in front of the school, and they could see where they were. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to have three parts to it. First part, we explained to them how to use the equipment, and you go through all of, well, what's ARDF. Second part is they test out their receivers, make sure they understand how it works, get a good feeling. And then the third part was there were three more transmitters hidden in the woods behind the school. And, you know, if we never got to that third part, that would have been fine with me,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it seemed like a lot really complicated.
Yeah.
And I finished up my part of the explanation and stuff, and you put in your few words about stuff that you thought was important,
mm-hmm.
and then they're standing there, and they've had the receivers for half the time of this little talk.
And they've turned up the volume, they've listened into a few
exactly.
as you were talking.
Yeah. So I thought we were going to, you know, I'm just waiting for the first question to show up. It's like, you know, I totally can't hear anything, or blah, blah, blah. And the very first thing I hear is, okay, let's go. And they start walking away. And I'm like, okay.
They had ditched the three practice ones immediately
and
moved on to the ones that were not where they could see. They're like, yeah, we got it. We can see it. Yeah.
So you went off with them.
Yeah, I was trying to keep up because there's some sixth graders who I wasn't sure could make it around.
Oh, there were some sixth graders in the first group?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. There were
two
of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I thought that was a good idea because I assumed they were going to get out there and then not know what to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, can they possibly understand all of this? Even early on, and I put this in the blog, the first thing that one of them said during the talk was, this is really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, this is really complicated.
Right.
You know? And I was perfectly happy saying that, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is, it's supposed to be. So when they went off, I decided I really need to stay here because we told them when they're done finding the other three, they come back here and we get their times, right?
Right.
And so I stayed there and I was testing one of the ones that had broken down that we had kept behind. And I recorded the time, I'm trying to remember, I think just 10 minutes later, the first three come running around the corner of, and they're just beeline right for me. They see me and they just, they were running around the corner, they see me and they just go right for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they arrive breathless, got all three, they show me the little chits that they'd ripped off the strings that we'd put with each transmitter. And I thought, wow. And you, I think you went and got a bunch more of the kids, right?
I was tracking the last few.
Yeah.
And I told them, oh, you just got the last one. Did you want to go around and check in with Mr. Sears to see if you, you know, to see your time? Mm-hmm. And so they're like, no, yes, no, yes. And then they're like, yeah, we want to see your time. Then they ran off. And then by that time, two that just checked in with you had come running by. And I said, could you go and tell two other students that they could come out and do it? And so they actually came over. They got one of them, the one I was very excited about, Artif, went over, got the two students, pulled them around. And by the time I got around the building, which was all of, what, 3 minutes after you had, you know, talked to them and given them their time, the one that was so excited decided Patrick was not going to describe Artif. He was going to describe it to the new students and tell them the way he described it. That just cracked me up.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny because I heard echoes of myself. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I started with after describing what ARDF was what are the parts of the receiver?
Yeah, that's what cracked me up.
And I just mentioned the ones that would be important to them, which are basically two knobs, one for frequency and for volume. You know, get the gain one, and then the button with the sense antenna, and the antenna itself, because how you hold the antenna makes a difference as to what you'll hear. And so he starts kind of talking about different things haphazardly, but it only says just a few seconds, then he stops, thinks for a second, and says, okay, there are so many parts to a receiver. There are two knobs. Let's start with the knobs. Anyway, so that was a real blast.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was a phenomenal success in my book.
Yeah, and even the two students that were only out there for 5 minutes, they're like, well, we want to go out again. This wasn't a full one, you know. I'm like, I know, but it gave you a taste.
So, Isaac,
yeah,
you Isaac? Wanted to find out about Isaac's SSH stuff?
Yeah,
sure.
So, tell us.
So, I had a problem, and my problem was that I've got a desktop at home that's got lots of computational power, but I like going out to coffee shops and stuff with my laptop. Obviously not as powerful. So the problem is, how do you get all the computational power of your desktop without having to drag it around everywhere you go? And my solution was to access my desktop remotely by configuring my router to do port forwarding. And exactly how to do that is sort of beyond our scope right now, but essentially you want to go into your router configurations, and there are a lot of good Google tutorials on how to do that, and just forward one external port on your router to an internal port on your desktop and start up an SSH connection, which will allow you to remotely control your desktop through a console so that you can compile code or whatever you have to do. And once you get that one port connection going, you can really go much more beyond just console control of your desktop by using a SOX proxy, which you can configure with SSH dynamic port forwarding. Again, sort of exactly how to do that is beyond the scope, but there are a lot of good Google tutorials. If you use these SOX proxies, you can actually run your browser on your laptop, but display pages as if you're accessing them from your desktop, which is really handy. And then you can get into remote desktop connections with screen forwarding so that you can actually see your desktop screen on your laptop, although I found those to be a little slow for your typical coffee shop Wi-Fi connection.
Okay, so we can't let you go on there. That's where I totally went, whoa. You can run a browser on your laptop but then see the graphical interface as if it was running on your desktop. So what's happening is you're running the browser on your laptop.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
So by I'm not sure about Chrome and Internet Explorer, but Firefox, you can configure it to use a SOX proxy instead of your laptop's normal network interface.
Okay.
So use SSH dynamic port forwarding to establish a SOX proxy, and essentially all that does is all traffic that goes into the SOX proxy gets copied over to wherever you directed it. So
you send that to your desktop.
Yeah, so all that traffic gets forwarded to your desktop, and let's say your desktop is VPN into some private network.
Uh-huh.
So you just, let's say you request foo.com, which you know is a site on the VPN accessible from your desktop, but you're in a coffee shop.
Right.
So
got it.
You type in Firefox, which is configured to use this proxy. I want foo.com. Foo.com request gets sent to the SOX proxy running on your laptop. That SOX proxy with SSH dynamic port forwarding gets forwarded to your router, which has a port forwarding scheme to forward it to your desktop, and then your desktop captures it, and is also running this SOX software that you set up, and it will execute that GET request that you originally asked for on your laptop.
Uh-huh.
And then it gets the contents of that GET request, and the whole process happens in reverse.
And sends it to your laptop.
Yeah, it goes back to the SOX proxy, and then the page pops up in Firefox on your laptop, as if you're sitting on your desktop.
Cool.
So how long did this take you?
It took me probably a few weeks just to figure out, like, make all the configurations happen, figure out the theory.
So for the first step, to just SSH the first time.
But just setting up an SSH connection, now I have a script on my computer that does it in 2 seconds. Just have to run the script, write a password, all the SOX proxies are set up,
wow.
Everything gets set up, and ready to go.
Wow. But that took, the whole process took 3 weeks initially.
Yeah, if you got the knowledge to do it, initial configuration really won't take more than a few hours. Figuring it all out, if you got no knowledge walking into it, it's going to take a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really handy tool once you got it up and running.
Nice. I was just... It's always nice to know kind of how long it took someone to get comfortable with a totally new system.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you start out, you don't know if it's going to be like a quick hour job or, you know, the next week I'll be trying to troubleshoot this until I get it going and up
right.
and running.
Right, yeah.
Okay. Nice. Very nice.
Your blog?
Oh, my blog.
Okay. None of these are up yet.
Yeah.
But they're written.
Yeah, so my blog, I talked about setting up the makerspace next year for enrichment and that. And I think I will have to focus more on what we talked about earlier with setting up specific projects that the students will do. And instead of like kind of a free flow where people would come in, and some people would do some things, some people would do others. What I found is, like, the students I'm trying to target, which is a larger variety of students than would normally be building in a makerspace, and specifically girls and my students of color, where I'm trying to get them in, I found just their limited experience is stopping them from having that feeling like they can create something or try and maybe not get the project done the way they expected. And that really became evident to me when I was writing this drone grant with these two girls and a boy. And the two girls have never built anything before. The boy has built quite a bit. He's done some programming in that. And we get the grant all the way written, and I'm putting it into Donors Choose and just sending the send button, and the one girl goes, maybe you shouldn't put it in because what happens if it doesn't work? I was like, it doesn't matter if it doesn't work. It's also about the process and learning something and trying to troubleshoot it. And you may get something that's up and running, and it may not happen in the time frame that you have. And I said, but both are great. Both are building experience. And she's like, I don't know. And so it took me, like, you know, I was going to meet them again at lunch because she dropped me on, or she said this to me during class. And I was meeting the group at lunch that day, a few hours after. So then I was like, didn't you ever see those NASA rockets that all went kaplooey before they put a man on the moon? I said, that's sort of what you're doing. You're figuring it out for the first time. And then she's like, okay, I want you to put it in. And the next day she's like, did donors choose contact you? Did they post it? But it's like that experience building of just very simple projects is so necessary just to get students to dream and to think about, wow, it'd be really cool to take on this project or this project. So that's my goal.
Well, that sounds good. I think
we're pretty much at an end.
I think so. This is the first time we said we're going to really do a shorter one.
Let's move the mic back again.
And we actually managed to do it.
Really?
We're at 47 minutes.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Usually we say that, and it goes an hour and 45 minutes.
I need my notes.
Yeah, that's fine.
Well, we didn't cover your Neanderthal one. That's okay.
That's okay. We'll come back to it.
Okay. Thank you for listening to the Island CT Podcast.
Make sure to check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.